Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in. Early this morning, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted that he wants to cancel a deal with Boeing to build two new planes for Air Force One. The 747 jet that carries the president is assembled in Everett. Trump says the costs are out of control, that Boeing will be paid $4 billion.
I think it's ridiculous. I think Boeing is doing a little bit of a number. We want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not that much money.
Let's straighten this out with the aviation editor for CNN, John Ostrower. John, welcome to KUOW.
Hey, thank you very much.
Is Trump's tweet accurate?
Isn't accurate. Well, when you look at, there is a plan to replace Air Force One with new Boeing airplanes. Yes. Is there a contract in place that you will see anywhere on Boeing's books for two new 747-8s to be modified into Air Force One presidential transports? Not yet. Right now, there's about $170 million that's been spent to do preliminary design work on two new airplanes. Looking at what the DOD has identified as their budget for this, so between here and 2021, and again, budgets can change, the number is a lot closer to $2.8 billion, not $4 billion. Right now, that $4 billion number isn't entirely clear. And right now, even the features of the airplane are yet to be defined. What are the bells and whistles? What are the communication systems? What does this airplane actually require? And that's going to be fleshed out over the next, you know, year or so as we get a clearer picture of what the either a second notional Trump term or the 46th president of the United States is going to use for Air Force One.
Okay, we don't know where Trump got the $4 billion number. When Trump takes office in January, does he have the power as president to snap his fingers and cancel that order?
Well, certainly historical precedent suggests yes. The Obama administration actually did cancel a program that was meant to replace Marine One, the president's helicopter, because the aircraft had gotten too physically heavy, weighed down with systems, and it had become a poster child for how messy the procurement process is inside the Pentagon, and that's gone. And the president and President Obama has been using aircraft that we've become quite familiar with for decades that have landed on the South Lawn. So certainly presidential power allows this. I think the important thing to remember is that we're so early on in this process that it's not clear where this number is coming from, whether or not there are cost overruns already for a program that hasn't even gotten going. And so the murkiness of this is ultimately illustrative of the fact that this tweet created far more chaos and confusion than clarity.
Okay, but you're saying there's some precedent for this, so Obama canceling Marine One. I want to talk, John Ostrower, about it with CNN. You've been digging through Trump's old tweets about Boeing. He's a Boeing shareholder. What else is their relationship like?
So Donald Trump's relationship with Boeing goes back decades. The Trump shuttle, actually, were Boeing 727s that were built in Renton. And then he right now is a Boeing customer today. You know, his black, red and gold 757, also built in Renton, right in the same line. He's a Boeing customer through and through. And so he has tweeted in the past about the 787 and was quite vocal around when the airplane was grounded back in the first part of 2013 regarding its lithium ion batteries. Said I wouldn't want to fly it. I don't want to fly an airplane with lithium ion batteries. And I think what's illustrative at this point is that this is the difference between private citizen, billionaire, real estate mogul Donald Trump and President-elect Donald Trump, and the difference with how his Twitter communications and also his public statements are interpreted as future commander in chief and leader of the world's largest economy.
We're getting used to a president-elect calling out specific companies with the carrier air conditioner jobs. How has Boeing responded?
Well, Boeing has said not a whole lot, and they sort of woke up to this morming wondering what inspired this in the first place. I think it's important to remember that the Trump presidential transition does have personnel inside the Pentagon looking at budget items and looking at various procurement efforts that are going on, probably getting some information about that. We don't know if that's what inspired this, but certainly the president-elect has access to a different level of information than candidate Trump and certainly private citizen Trump. You know, and when you kind of step back from that, you look at a relationship with private industry that is far more hands-on and company by company as we kind of advance into what is going to be the governing of the Trump administration.
We're talking with CNN's aviation editor, John Osterhauer. Any we care about Boeing jobs in the Puget Sound area. Any sense how nervous we should be about Boeing's relationship with an activist new president?
Well, I think the Air Force One is, okay, let's for a second say that this is a multi-billion-dollar contract. We know that it is right now. So if it goes away, that is a big hit to its defense business. That's several billion dollars worth of revenue that will not be generated by the company, and that's work that it won't have to do, and that's a program that it counts on and believes it is a strategic imperative for the future image of the company, because Air Force One is as much a flying ambassador for
right.
U.S. industry as it is anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes far beyond this. Boeing as the America's largest exporter. It has a unique role and a unique relationship with many parts of the world that have garnered the criticism of President-elect Trump. Whether it's trade deals with China, whether it's the Iran deal and the jetliners that the Islamic Republic has ordered. So there are, and obviously the Ex-Im Bank on top of that. So there are a lot of different. There are a lot of different pieces here where this is a relatively small portion. But as we see kind of their relationship, it's certainly a new dialogue around China and Taiwan, that could have a serious impact potentially for Boeing, with a lot to lose if the trade relationship with China changes. And you head over right down East Marginal Way in Seattle, and that delivery center at Boeing Field is filled with airplanes for China. That is, they are about a third to a quarter to a third of the airplanes that Boeing delivers today, and that's a huge portion of its production. So the stakes are high.
We in the media sometimes debate how seriously to take President-elect Trump's tweets. It sounds like CNN's aviation editor, John Osterhauer, takes it seriously enough, at least for now. John, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Earlier today, the state congressional delegation said replacing the 26-year-old Air Force One aircraft will support good-paying jobs throughout Northwest Washington and is important to assuring the safety and security of future presidents. The president-elect's tweet does nothing to change those basic facts. It's KUOW's The Record. Now, from one big local employer to another, from Boeing to Amazon. If you hate waiting in line at the store, you might be in luck, thanks to an announcement from Amazon this week that they'll open an automated convenience store in Seattle with no checkout. You walk in, you pick up your groceries, you walk out. Here's part of the ad for the store, supposedly coming to Seattle's Belltown neighborhood.
Use the Amazon Go app to enter. Then put away your phone and start shopping. It's really that simple. Take whatever you like. Anything you pick up is automatically added to your virtual cart. If you change your mind about that cupcake, just put it back. Our technology will update your virtual cart automatically.
This no cash, no cards, no lines store is called Amazon Go, and the announcement has Forbes staff writer Ryan Mack a little skeptical. He wants to know, can you buy a single grain of salt at this new store? And there's a reason he wants to know that.
I think just because of the lack of details on what this could actually be, there's a website that Amazon put up, and they compared it, the technology being used, to those in self-driving cars, and they use a lot of buzzwords to illustrate what they're doing. But, I mean, that doesn't really help us understand how this will actually work. And you got to view this story as well in the context of the holidays. I mean, Amazon... This is the most important quarter for Amazon going into Christmas. And you kind of think that this is almost a marketing tactic from them to kind of get a mind share among their customers. I mean, if you're shopping online and you want to buy your new computer for your son or something else for your daughter, and you see this Amazon Go thing and you think about shopping on Amazon first as opposed to Best Buy or on Walmart. I mean, that's a huge win for Amazon, and I think that plays into their strategy here.
So even if the store might end up looking overhyped, we're talking about Amazon right when people are buying stuff more than
exactly.
ever.
Exactly. And I mean, you go on Google right now, Google News, and there's pages and pages of stories on this store, everyone writing about it, everyone talking about it. It was trending pretty highly on Twitter yesterday. So it's a pretty successful strategy if you think about it for Amazon, who controls about 31% of all online shopping during the holidays.
You write that Amazon becomes the publicity king around the holidays.
I did.
Examples, please?
Yes. So in 2013, Jeff Bezos goes on 60 Minutes and presents the drone delivery program, which was talked about in great length at the time and still is. The year after that, they gave tours of their facilities, showing off their Kiva robots. And last year, they kind of did an update on their drone delivery system, displaying kind of new designs and kind of trial videos for that program. I guess this year is the Amazon Go thing.
Well, you're right that drones aren't delivering yet, but that's an airspace regulation problem. Amazon has actually opened up brick-and-mortar stores, and they are doing automation. They have the Echo device that answers your questions and other things. So is there something about this automated convenience store idea that seems hinky to you?
I don't ever fault Amazon on its execution, and I think they have done a lot of things that they said they would do. I just think it's a little early to kind of... I saw a lot of headlines yesterday about these stores being game changers for retail or these stores completely disrupting retail, and we have yet to kind of see what this thing will actually be. And so to make those kinds of big judgment calls is kind of just strange to me. So it's kind of a wait and see kind of thing, more so than a critique of their execution.
I've seen some writers say, wait a minute, so a bunch of people are at a store and are grabbing a similar item. How do you know what's going where? It seems like a big engineering problem to some people.
I think there's a social problem, engineering problem, a lot of things in there. I mean, yeah, basic questions as to what happens if I'm overcharged? What happens if I break something in the store? What happens if there's a shoplifting incident? I mean, I'm sure they've thought about all these things, and this is not something that is just surfacing now. But it's just kind of one of those things that you really need to see in action for you to actually make a judgment on how successful it'll be. But yeah, a lot of those questions were floating on Twitter yesterday about how this would work.
Okay, Christmas is the season for being dubious. That's Ryan Mack, staff writer at Forbes. And thanks for talking with us about the new yet-to-come Amazon Go store.
Thank you.
Amazon says that store with no checkouts will be opening in Belltown, 7th and Blanchard, sometime in early 2017. It's KUOW's The Record. Museums and historians are polishing exhibits and remembrance programs for the 75th anniversary tomorrow of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. That surprise attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet drew the U.S. into World War II. A Pearl Harbor survivor who now lives in Lincoln City, Oregon, has vivid memories of that day. Ed Johan was a 17-year-old apprentice seaman. He was crewing a hospital ship's water taxi when the first fighter bombers came over the horizon. Here's the Navy veteran in his own words.
Well, on December 7th, I had been in the Navy about 6 months. And because it was Sunday, a lot of buddies, guys wanted to go visit other ships with the family members or their other buddies, and it was down in a 36-foot motor, open motor launch with wooden seats in it. Mm-hmm. And we were waiting there to take these fellows to these places they wanted to go when we looked up in the air, and there was full of airplanes. I was thinking, like a lot of other guys, that we thought it was some kind of a drill. Why are they drilling on Sunday? You know, in the peacetime Navy, everything was different. Well, I noticed that the dive bombers were coming out of the sun. You couldn't see them. You could hear them. And then you just got a flash of them as they went by and dropped their... And then they fly right up into that black smoke and you didn't see them again. Without anyone telling us what to do, the two other fellows and I that are in this launch, we went over to the battleships, and they were lowering wounded guys down to us. Later, some of the battleships, instead of us lowering down wounded to us, they were jumping off themselves. They were abandoning ship because the ship was sinking, and with a lot of guys in the water. There's a lot of oil on the water. A lot of oil was burning that was on the water. And we were pulling the guys into the boat, and some of them, it's hard to do because you grab their arm and pull, and you just got a handful of skin, or they'd be coated with oil, and it's hard to get a hold, grasp something someplace to get a hold of the guy to get him in the boat.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press.
We just kept on like that. I have no idea how many fellas we saved that day. The other two guys in the boat and I, we never did get hit. I don't know. They surely were shooting at us because they were shooting at everything in the harbor.
A date which will live in infamy.
Well, I had thought if I lived through this, everybody making promises, and I'll never swear again. I'll never drink. You know, I'll never stay up late. I'll be like a monk. But I figured to myself. I figured if I lived through this, I'm going to not dedicate myself, but I'm going to try to do an experience to help other people. So I got on the Portland Fire Department for 28 years, saving lives and property. And at the same time, I worked as a volunteer on Mountain Rescue, and we'd go up and find people that were lost, or sometimes we'd just recover a body.
That was 93-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Ed Johann of Lincoln City, Oregon, talking with our correspondent Tom Bonsi. For his actions that day, Johann received the Navy Commendation Medal with a V for Valor. He and eight other Northwest people with notable connections to World War II in the Pacific will be speaking on a panel tomorrow night at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland. That 75th anniversary remembrance, free and open to the public if you're down that way. This is KUOW's The Record. Our next story is about a consequence of military service that we don't talk about much. Thousands of veterans have combat injuries that have left them infertile. For the first time, Congress is trying to address that issue. A newly passed law directs the VA to start paying for wounded vets' fertility treatments, including in vitro fertilization for veterans and their spouses. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports.
When Jeff Lynch left his new bride, Christy, and deployed to Iraq as an infantry soldier in 2005, Christy says neither one of them were thinking about children.
When Jeff and I got married, we were 18. We didn't expect to need IVF to have a family.
Jeff was injured during his first deployment. When he deployed again, a second injury ended his military career.
We were on a convoy and we got hit with a daisy chain. A daisy chain is basically, they put an IED, which is an improvised explosive device, every 10 to 15 meters apart or 200 meters apart.
Lynch has endured more than 100 surgeries. Though the couple has one child, the lingering effects of his injuries and his medications have left him unable to have more children naturally. So the Lynches began exploring in vitro fertilization, but the procedure's $15,000 cost was daunting for the family.
It was something that we could afford and we could make it work, but it was something we weren't comfortable putting all of that money into without having a guaranteed outcome.
IVF is financially out of reach for many wounded vets' families, and since 1992, Congress has banned the VA from paying for it. Democratic Washington Senator Patty Murray has been fighting to lift the ban since 2012, and this fall, she finally succeeded. Now the VA will pay for IVF for wounded veterans injured during their service.
We all say when someone serves our country, we are there for them when they come home. Certainly, allowing them to fulfill their dream of having a family ought to be part of what we are there for them when they return.
Murray says one of the reasons it took so long was resistance from conservative lawmakers.
Individual lawmakers were making a decision having to do with a woman's right to choose, not about making sure that these men and women could fulfill their dream through IVF.
Christy and Jeff Lynch were one of several couples who lobbied lawmakers for the bill. They encountered the same concerns.
One of the questions we were asked was, you know, what do you do with your leftover embryos? You know, the response that we had to that was, none of your business what we choose to do with our leftover embryos. You know, those are ours.
The new law came too late to help the Lynches. By the time it passed, they had already undergone IVF through a doctor who treats wounded vets for a reduced fee. And now they're expecting twins.
I built stuff out of wood, so I built that toy box for my daughter.
The Lynch's small three-bedroom house near Raleigh, North Carolina, is already crowded with toys that belong to their seven-year-old daughter, Caitlin. And the tight space is about to get tighter.
I just want her and the two babies come out healthy. That's all I want.
And Christy wants all wounded veterans to have the option of using IVF under their VA benefits. The new law is only temporary. It expires in 2 years, and Christy plans to keep fighting to make it permanent.
Jeff has a friend who is almost like a brother to him, who is a paraplegic, and you know, we didn't want him and his future wife to have to fight this battle.
Congressional supporters estimate that as many as 2,000 wounded vets could potentially pursue IVF through the VA. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. When Donald Trump was elected president, Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo started worrying about how Trump's policies will affect the Affordable Care Act and the people who depend on it, about undocumented immigrants, and about emboldened hate groups and a purported increase in hate speech. So Ijeoma wrote a list. She called it, "What I'm Doing to Get My Black Ass Ready for the Next 4 Years."
I'm going to a doctor. I'm meeting with my children's schools. I'm strengthening ties with my community of color. I'm reaffirming boundaries with allies. I'm identifying programs. I'm prioritizing my mental and physical health. I'm making lists. And I'm seeking out positivity every day.
Why'd you decide to put this list together?
You know, I think that there has been a lot of hand-wringing in the last couple of weeks, which is completely understandable. And I think right now there's this feeling of doom and dread, like the worst is already upon us. And
is that what you're hearing from friends too?
Yes, it is. I'm hearing it from a lot of people in the local community and online. You know, this is real sense almost of defeat. And what I wanted to get people focused on is, no matter what, we have a lot of work that we're going to have to do in order to protect ourselves, protect others, and really make sure that, you know, values of justice and equality aren't lost in these next 4 years. But I think what people are also forgetting is we actually still have 7 weeks, that we still have this administration, that we still have, you know, these support systems in place that we can be leveraging. We have research we can do right now before the real stress of the next 4 years actually starts, to really get ready to start this new year strong.
I didn't expect to see at the top of your list, "I'm going to the doctor."
Yeah.
What's that about? Yeah.
I wouldn't have expected it either, honestly. That was a real visceral reaction. And it was something that was really confirmed in speaking with a lot of other people as well. Really, you know, my first concern when I woke up was, I have got a huge battle ahead of me and I have to be healthy. I have to be able to physically hold myself together while I'm doing some really tough mental work. And so I immediately made an appointment for my doctor, and I avoid the doctor. You know, I guess it's ironic to say like the plague, but I do avoid the doctor like the plague. And I called my brother and he said, "Man, Ijeoma, I have been running like 5 miles a day every day since this election." And I was at a meeting with other journalists and they were saying, "You know what? I've made appointments with my doctor as well." I think, you know, a lot of what we've realized now is mental strain takes a lot of the same out of you as physical strain does. And if you don't have the physical capacity and your health isn't in order and your mental health isn't in order, it's going to be very hard to take on additional stressors. And we are looking at additional stressors.
You met with your children's schools. What do you want from them? What did they say?
Yes, and that was a really wonderful meeting. I had a couple of meetings actually with different administrators in the schools. And, you know, for me, my primary concern, part of why I do what I do my whole career, is around my children and making sure that, you know, they are inheriting a better world than what we live in right now. And I saw the impact that this election has had on my sons, and I know that they're not alone. I knew that there were a lot of children of color who felt really betrayed, a lot of LGBT kids who felt really betrayed. I know a lot of kids with undocumented parents who are in a lot of fear. And our children spend most of their time at school. And I really did want to know what our schools were doing to fight that. And another thing that I have learned in working with schools over the years is, you know, they are stressed, they are taxed, and what gets addressed is what is most urgently asked for. And so I felt like I would not be doing my duty if I didn't let the school know that as a parent, my top concern was that they were doing their best to insulate our children from the impacts of this election and making sure that they were safe at school.
How would they do that?
You know, a lot of what we've been talking about are, you know, how they're addressing bullying policies. You know, there has been an uptick in bullying in many of the schools. And so making sure that they are reiterating with the kids that this is a safe place and that this sort of language and behavior is not tolerated. Increasing their capacity to add counseling services. A lot of schools, especially in Seattle, are incredibly understaffed as far as school counselors. And so knowing that they're going to have an increased need to meet students' needs, increase services for, you know, students whose parents are undocumented and for undocumented students as well, and making sure that they read up on these issues and know how to talk to their kids about this, making sure that they have translators, if necessary, to speak to parents to make sure this is all being communicated as well.
You also have a message in there to white liberals. You didn't say it exactly that way, but that's how I took it, that guess what? This is your problem.
Yes. You know, the message that I put out there is because I've been seeing this a lot, and I've seen it not only with how people have been acting towards me, but towards many other people as well. You know, I understand that I'm a writer, so people often do come to me for certain answers. But I noticed that people seem to be reaching out to their friend of color and saying, how do I fix this? And what I think a lot of people forget is, first off, it's always problematic to expect people of color to fix a system that they are inherently disempowered in. But also that they are feeling a lot of pain and a lot of fear right now and a lot of stress. And a lot of what people are thinking are more hypotheticals of, you know, well, this will, you know, it will be hard to see my friends go through this. It will be hard to see my community go through this. For people of color, this is a direct attack and this is a direct threat that will, you know, really harm them. They are seeing an increase in hate attacks and things like this. So, you know, to see this onslaught of people, and I did literally have dozens of people every single day for probably 2 weeks after the election just asking me, tell me what to do. Tell me personally what to do. Tell me what to do. And I'm like, you know what? Right now I'm hugging my children. I'm trying to take a deep breath. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get through this. So my message was really, you know, be cognizant of the labor that you're asking people because you have the work to do. You're going to enter this with much more power than anyone else. And you don't start by expecting people of color to start carrying that load.
I'm talking with Ijeoma Oluo, editor-at-large of The Establishment, about her list, what I'm going to do to get my black ass ready for the next 4 years. How is having a list, Ijeoma, how's that working for you?
You know, the lists are helping. It's changing, definitely. I think starting out with a list, putting down your options is always important. I think a lot of the rhetoric, especially around elections and around politics and around society, is that problems are too big to solve, that it is too all-encompassing to even start. So sitting down and making a list of small things that you can do right now can really help ground you and realize that, you know, all big problems are solved through small changes and small steps. And so making a list, looking at it, checking it off, changing it, sharing it with friends and community members is a really great way to not only keep yourself motivated and feel empowered, but to keep your community motivated as well.
You said you want to resist division. Do you think about your political opponents? Are they your enemy? Do you think about how they think, how they view what you do? Is that on your list of things to think about?
You know, for me, my enemy, I guess, if you were to say enemy, is not individual people. My enemy is the normalization of hate. And so where I find that in language, where I find that in film, where I find that in actions, that's what I will fight. So for me, I rarely, if you look at my work, you will rarely see me single out individual people, except for perhaps Donald Trump and what he represented to this entire nation. For me, it's that normalization. For me, the enemy is where people can say really hateful things and it gets laughed off. And people say, oh, that's just a difference of opinion. That, to me, is the enemy. So I think, you know, normalizing these sorts of things can turn really good people really ugly very fast. So that's my primary focus.
The final thing on your list is about seeking positivity. What's that look like for you?
Yeah, you know, this is really important. We have been so inundated. I think it's, you know, people feel like there's urgency, that we see what's happening, that we see the real threat, that people believe it now. And so what we're seeing is a flood of evidence of wrongdoing and hurt and hatred being perpetrated on everyday Americans. And that can really have a negative impact on you. And I think it's really important that we stay informed, but it's also important that we stay informed by about the good that is happening right now. We have to know the good things that our friends and community members are doing. We have to be able to find joy, because we have to remember what we're fighting for. It's not just about what we're fighting against. It's what we're fighting for. And we're fighting for our community, which is full of love and full of talent, you know, and full of camaraderie. And we have to focus on that. So, you know, for me, it's really, you know, seeking out the everyday efforts that people are doing to stand up and resist hatred and resist division. It's seeing, you know, even just seeing children smile. For me right now, seeing Black kids smile in a time where it really feels like Blackness is under assault has been really, you know, empowering for me, and to remember that I am fighting to preserve that joy every day.
That's Ijeoma Oluo, editor at large of the feminist website The Establishment. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. That is the sound of the collision. That's a boat called Naptime colliding with a Washington State ferry on Sunday near Vashon Island. The captain of that cruiser was reportedly in the bathroom when the boats hit, and boy, could that have been worse. We called up the Northwest Maritime Center in Port Townsend and asked Executive Director Jake Beatty who messed up and how.
You know, they're like most events that happen at sea that end badly. There's usually a sequence of events that go, things that go wrong. And it's easy to point out some of them. You know, both of these vessels, at some point, the ferry realized that they were in a collision course and started doing things like sounding the horn, and then they started changing course and backing up. So that was some good stuff that happened. Bad stuff that happened, clearly the other boat, the Naptime, the ironically named Naptime,
mm-hmm.
It's clear that no one was at the helm at the controls until much after the collision.
Who had the right of way?
It's a good question, and I'm sure there's maritime folks like to argue a lot of things, and there's arguments on both sides. So just like traffic on shore, traffic on the water has rules, and there's boats that are supposed to keep doing what they're doing and boats that are supposed to get out of the way. And depending on which rule you look at, you can make an argument for both sides. So on a very basic level, the guy on the right is supposed to keep doing what he's doing. So in this case, that rule says the Naptime had the right of way. But there's also rules that say you're supposed to keep an active lookout, which means someone on your boat should be paying attention to collisions. There's also a rule that says large passenger vessels in the Puget Sound should be stayed away from by at least 500 yards. And there's my favorite rule of all the rules says, if you have to deviate from the rules to avoid collision, please do so. And that kind of trumps all the other ones in my mind. And then there's just sort of the rule of common sense, or what I like to say, call the law of asymmetrical consequences, is that small boats should generally get out of the way of big boats.
Yeah, that's the one my mind went to watching that video. Stay on deck and just get out of the way.
Yeah.
But there's some contention there. So if there are repair bills or medical bills, who pays?
It would surprise me if the owner of the boat that was basically unmanned would go after the state for the repair bills. My hunch is that the ferry is fine. I mean, that's 5 million pounds of steel. I'm surprised that the little boat Spears have come out as unscathed as they have.
I think we were all surprised by that. It could have been a lot worse.
I mean, it's kind of the best version of a really bad scenario.
How common is that for boat captains to just not be at the wheel?
You know, that's a good question, and my hunch is more often than we'd like. And it's certainly, there's some logic to that. You can look from that video that's a really nice day, the visibility is really good, and there's, other than these two boats on the water, there's not much other boats out there. looks like the guy had it on autopilot. So barring a you know a big accident or something like this where he missed that a ferry was there, this boat was only going about 8 miles an hour, so a light jog. It's the risks normally for ducking down and pretty low. This one clearly a miscalculation of that risk.
Reportedly, the captain was in the bathroom. I don't suppose that's a good enough excuse.
No, but a convenient place considering how he must have felt at the time of collision. That might have been a scary moment.
I hadn't thought of that. What could the ferry captain and crew have done differently, if anything?
That's an interesting question. I mean, these are highly trained mariners who do their jobs day in and day out, very, very familiar with how to navigate safely. And in an area that, they're used to having a lot of amateur boaters, recreational boaters around them and pretty close. So my hunch is that this is not the first time a boat, they've honked at a boat and said, hey, remember, we're over here. Please get out of our way. And 99.99% of the time, someone will respond to that. So the only thing really that they could have done differently is done everything they did, but 30 seconds earlier. That's about it.
Why did that boat just bounce off?
Well, I think part of it is luck of having the boat be the boat it was, and part of it was really the skill of the captain and crew on board the Chetsumoka.
So that's a resume highlight reel for the ferry captain and a nice ad for that cruiser. It can take a licking.
Bill, you can find a silver lining in anything. That's great.
Finally, Jake, what else should we know about big ferries and small craft?
The best advice I give people is aim for the stern of the boat. If you think you're going to hit a ferry and you're even potentially worried about it, don't aim at the front of it. Aim behind it. You'll never hit the ferry if you aim behind it. And the other one is get educated. The Northwest Maritime Center is one of a number of organizations that provides boater education. Not that it's necessarily required, but as you can see, it's good to know how not to hit things on the water. You have a much better day if you don't run into something, especially high profile on YouTube like that. So whether it's our organization or any other organization around the state, just when you're on the water, make sure you're doing it right and from an informed place. And if the captain of the Naptime wants a refresher course, I'd be happy to give it to him free of charge.
Did you hear that, Naptime Captain Clark Swanson? Clark Swanson! Did you hear that invitation?
He might be in the bathroom.
Jack Beattie is executive director of the Northwest Maritime Center in Port Townsend. There's a boating news website called Three Sheets Northwest that reported on that collision. And in the comment section, someone claiming to be the captain of that motorboat wrote in saying, I didn't see him. That was my mistake. And then this person describes what it's like to collide with the Washington State Ferry. Quote, I've been in auto accidents, but that's the hardest I've ever been hit. Everything on this boat ended up on the floor. Every cabinet, closet, cupboard, light fixture, furniture, TV, internet modem, radar, GPS, radio, stereo, toolboxes, and everything else that was above floor level. It will cost me, but I am alive, and no diesel was spilled. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. Let's stay on the water now and talk big money and oceans and your dinner plate. United States waters provide some of the most sustainable seafood in the world, in large part because America set hard limits for how many fish can be caught. But the enforcement of those limits has changed over time. 4 years ago, the government privatized fishing rights. They're called catch shares. And if you got a catch share, you own it forever. Reporter Lee Vandervoo is managing director of Investigate West. Her new book, The Fish Market, looks into who wins and who loses with the catch share system.
Well, if you got a piece, chances are you're doing pretty good. If you didn't, you now have to buy your way in, which can be very expensive.
Yes, so you have people who had a share early on, and it's like, as you say, they won the lottery.
Yeah, it's, really the equivalent of being given a house for free. It's a thing that can make money for you forever that you didn't have to pay anything for. It's a good deal.
And it gives us a sort of David Goliath rich poor. You describe it as a feudal landlord situation. Will you describe that?
Yeah, it does indeed. I mean, this was a tool that was supposed to boost the ecological health of fish and make fishing safer and bring better products to market. It has done all that. But it was a bit of a gamble, this ownership piece, and a little bit like giving, say, 100 houses to 100 people and betting that they're all going to cut their grass. I mean, you just don't know. And so the outcome here was mixed. The hope was that people who had ownership would become good stewards and conservationists. In a lot of cases, that did happen. And these are people that bring us some of the most amazing products on the market today. Unfortunately, a lot of people chose simply to become landlords. They rent their access to the sea to the people who do the work, which is putting a downward pressure on workers and making it more expensive to go out and fish with less profit.
And that downward pressure on workers, how does that affect those workers' lives?
You know, coastal communities for a long, long time, their backbone in many cases has been fishing. And what is happening in these situations where there's landlords moving in on coastal towns is that sometimes, you know, when they want to sell out or they just want to go somewhere different, they take that right with them. If it's going to go to the next highest bidder, it's going to go to somebody with a really deep pocket. It's going to be very, very difficult for the next generation for fishermen to be that deep pocket. Think of it as trying to buy a house from a landlord who keeps raising the rent on you. It's very hard to make it to the top of this industry. So what we're starting to see is, you know, larger corporations, investors, equity actors come in and buy these properties as the next generation of owners. And that really pulls money out of coastal towns, coastal economies. It consolidates business, and it does indeed collapse those small family fishing businesses that have been the economic spine of coastal communities for many, many years.
Of course, Lee, you researched your book On the Water in part. You went to sea. Can you tell us a story that brings all of this to life?
Oh, yeah, sure. I had a really fun time actually reporting some of this at sea. One of the things that I did was I went up and had a four-day fishing trip in Alaska in the halibut industry, and that's an industry where they actually require the landlords to ride on the boats with the fishermen.
The money person doesn't have to do any fishing, so
right.
They're just there.
Yeah, what you'll see in the halibut industry in Alaska especially is you'll see a lot of young fishermen and captains kind of tricking out their boats to attract landlords. You know, these folks are, they want to ride in style. They want to be as comfortable as they can be throughout the fishing trip. And they want to have something to do if they're not actually interested in fishing, which is often the case. So you'll see fishermen putting massive DVD collections on their boats, big screen TVs, in some cases sauna, or competing with the kind of food that they're willing to provide. As comfortable as they make these people, that translates into work for them.
That sounds like an awkward situation for everybody on that boat.
Yeah, you know, in the case of the boat that I rode on, the landlord was a retiring fisherman. He was older, and he assisted as much as he could, and that was about as good as it gets. I have heard some fascinating stories about landlords really pushing their crews to catch, you know, within a certain window because they got a tea time to make on Wednesday, and they'll be darned if they're going to miss their plane. It's almost treated a little bit like an inconvenient vacation, and the crew is, you know, really under the gun in some cases. The weather's just presumed to be fair, and the fish are biting.
But if a big part of the idea was to save disappearing species, has it worked? Environmentalists seem to like this sort of cap-and-trade system.
Yeah, they really do like it, or some really do like it. There is this social justice question of, you know, who benefits and who pays, but in terms of the ecological health, it is always a good idea to have a hard cap on how many fish can come out of the water. You know, since 2006, we have had that policy in the U.S. It's just a question of whether this is the tool we want to use to enforce it. So I think sometimes, you know, the question of whether privatization equals, you know, setting limits gets a little muddy. In reality, there are a lot of ways to set these limits, and the privatization piece is what has caused these downstream impacts to workers.
Well, what's a better way to regulate the fishing industry?
Well, one thing that gets tossed around is the idea that maybe, you know, seafood should work like any other natural resource extraction in the U.S. that comes from public property. So, for example, timber, mining, geothermal, solar, wind on public lands, grazing. They're all long-term leases where people have the advantage of having long-term access to the resource so that they can go ahead and make their business plans that are dependable and bankable, but they revert to the government over a certain period of time. That's not the case with with seafood these days and catch air systems, those properties, once they're given away, they can be sold on the private market, just like real estate or some kind of stock. And that is what creates these downstream impacts.
Did you always find in your reporting that the richer the player in the fishing industry is, the less deserving or less sympathetic they are?
No, not at all. Like I said, I mean, there are some folks who within the catch air system really did become the incredible stewards that environmental groups hoped for when they started pushing this policy. One of the things that I did in my book is I follow a company called Gulf Wild and a group of guys that try to design a product that they want to trace each individual fish from its place in the ocean and its journey through the supply chain to the consumer. And that's telling the consumer who the fishermen were that caught it, what kind of gear they used, what sort of boat they rode in on, where they were, where they landed it, who the processors were, and how it got to the grocery store or the restaurant where it was consumed. That's an incredible feat. And watching them attempt to do that was a great joy and really shows that there is such an interest in conservation and transparency for some of these owners. And they are the ones that buy into the system in a really big way. They really believe in it. In that case, Gulf Wild, they take a portion of proceeds and they put them into conservation efforts. And they have been amazingly good stewards of the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, so there's such a mix of winners and losers here. You're saying that ecologically, we've come a ways. This is a good thing. And yet you think there are better ways to regulate our fishing system. So should I be wanting a change? Should I be advocating for a new system? What's a listener to take away?
Well, ecologically, what really works is, again, it's just these hard caps on the sea. And I think that the private property piece is the piece that is kind of bungling things up. I think if a listener wanted to get really politically active here, then it would be lobbying for fair access for people to the sea and eliminating some of these landlord systems that have gotten in place that could take us in the wrong direction.
And if we were to favor small fishers in small coastal towns more, does that come at a price? Is there a sacrifice in that?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a good thing. It's just, engendering support for your coastal neighbors and trying to just pay attention to which products you buy. Those small fishermen are still out there. The more visible they make themselves to the buyer, the better. I'm here in Oregon, and I see in my community lots of visibility for folks who, for example, Port Orford Sustainable Seafood, all small boats, real small port. They pool their resources, and they ferry their catch up the I-5 corridor to consumers who are willing to pay just a little bit extra to know that that comes from a community that they support. I think programs like that are great, and that's one way to participate.
So, Lee, one takeaway I get is buy direct. Know a good fishmonger.
Yeah, know a good fishmonger. If you can't participate in one of these community-supported fisheries like I described, or you're not on the coast and you can't just buy from a fisherman, then just buy from somebody who knows what they're buying. There's lots of good fishmongers around. In fact, some of our major grocery stores, I've gone in and had conversations with people behind the fish counter just to see how much they know. And very often I find that they are pretty smart about this stuff. So I think it's just a question of having the conversation and buying things that you feel comfortable buying.
Lee Vandervoo is managing director of Investigate West, and her new book is The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along with us. America might be a forward-thinking country, but there's a lot we can learn from studying the past. So says book lover Nancy Pearl, who recommends a book about one of the leading political figures of the 20th century.
It's Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill by Candace Millard. And remember, Candace Millard's first book was River of Doubt, about Kermit Roosevelt's trip down the Amazon.
Right.
Which was so wonderful. And there are a couple people that you can't write a dull book about. And one of them is Theodore Roosevelt, and he was the subject of Candace Millard's first book. Another one is Winston Churchill.
Well, for people who maybe aren't up on their South African history, maybe you should explain what the Boer War was.
The Boer War, at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, Britain was in the process of claiming much of South Africa as part of the empire. But it was already settled by a group of people descended from the French Huguenots and the Dutch called the Boers, who had made a life there. And when Britain went to war against them, many things occurred.
And was Winston Churchill in the military at that time?
He was not. That's what's interesting. Winston Churchill. So this is just a little portion of Winston Churchill's long, expansive, fascinating life. And he comes across in this book, at least at the beginning, as a bit of a braggart and somebody who was so sure that his own future held greatness that he was willing to do anything. So he went to the Boer War. He went to South Africa as a reporter, but then got captured by the Boers. One of the things about the Boer War, Americans, we don't know very much about the Boer War. And one of the horrifying things about it is the way that the Brits treated the Boers and set up after, as the war was coming to an end, and Britain was either winning or losing. It's really hard to say who won and who lost, although Britain obviously, you know, conquered them in one way or another. They set up concentration camps. And these concentration camps were just, the people who were there were just kept in horrible conditions. And nothing was done until an intrepid woman reporter came there and saw the conditions and went back.
Is that in this book as well?
Yeah, it is in this book as well, just a little bit of it. But what I always remember is that someone once asked Hermann Göring about where they got the idea for the concentration camps, and he said, "We learned it from England."
Wow.
See, that's the thing about history. There's so, I mean, this is like ridiculous to say, but there's so much to it, and it just all intertwined, and there's no straight line from here to there. I mean, that's why I love history. And it's for people especially, I think, who love Winston Churchill. Churchill's a fascinating man, and Hero of the Empire is a good introduction to him.
Nancy Pearl recommends history books, fiction, travel books, and more every week on KUOW Seattle. You'll find all her recommendations at our website, kuow.org.